What is... Dax, are you...
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker? On all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge! Trucks up 3.9%!
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app.
Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Viet History Makers. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Pham.
Hello, everyone. My name is Kevin Pham. I'm an assistant professor of political theory at the University of Amsterdam, and I'm the author of The Architects of Dignity, Vietnamese Visions of Decolonization. In each episode of this sub-series, Viet History Makers, we provide a brief, modest introduction to a significant figure in Vietnamese history, with me playing the role of professor and Ken playing the role of student. And in today's episode, we will examine Ngo Dinh Diem, best known as the first president of South of Vietnam, or the Republic of Vietnam. How are you feeling, Ken? Are you ready?
I'm ready. I think that this is a very significant episode because Ngo Dinh Diem is full of love. He's very well loved by a certain subset of people, the Vietnamese American diaspora. He's, I think, American political people view him in a very, the neutral ones view him in a very interesting light as, and I think people in Vietnam probably see him in probably a darker light than, so I think he's a very polarizing figure. And I think when I think of him in relations to your family and my family, there's probably a lot of pedestalizing and hero worship that I actually would like to get to the bottom of all of it. So thank you for agreeing to do this with me.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to say that if I could add a seventh thinker to my book, because my book examines six important influential Vietnamese historical figures in the first half of the 20th century, so early 1900s to 1950s. But if I could add a seventh, it would be Ngo Dinh Diem. But he would become influential by the 1950s, so that's why I didn't include him. But if I could make a sequel, he would be another figure. So I think we should start off with a few caveats that I think are important. So he's, as you said, a very controversial figure. I think that him and Ho Chi Minh are probably the thorniest figures to examine. A lot of different people have very strong feelings about them, either intense support or intense criticism. So listener, I just want to remind you that we're giving you a very limited introduction to the life and ideas of and significance of Ngo Dinh Diem. So it's not at all a comprehensive exploration. A lot has been written about him, entire books even. And I just wanted to tell the audience a few good sources if you're interested in learning more about Ngo Dinh Diem. So here are the most up-to-date works of scholarship. So the first one that I would recommend is this book that I'm holding here called Misalliance, Ngo Dinh Diem, The United States and the Fate of South Vietnam by Edward Miller, published by Harvard University Press in 2013. There's another book, I don't have it with me, but it's called The Unimagined Community, Imperialism and Culture in South Vietnam by Duy Le Huyen, published by Manchester University Press in 2020. And also a book called Disunion, Anti-Communist Nationalism and the Making of the Republic of Vietnam by Nguyen Trung, published by University of Hawaii Press in 2022. And lastly, Building a Republican Nation in Vietnam, 1920 to 1963, edited by Nguyen An Xuân and Duong Vu, published by University of Hawaii Press, 2023. So I just wanted to mention those books. Yeah,
you had. I have a question. Yeah. And I often think about this, especially as it relates to Ngo Dinh Diem. You just listed four books. How do we as people know that these books are telling the truth? How do we know that they're not slanted? Why are you recommending these four when there's probably like 20 other books out there? You know what I mean? Because as I'm reading the comments in our episodes, I see that there are a lot of people who are very knowledgeable about the subjects that we're talking about. But why these four, and where do we sort of anchor our belief and say, well, that person's a South Vietnamese writer, or that person's a communist? How do we discern this?
That's a really excellent question. And the simple answer that I'm going to give is two words: peer review. So in academic scholarship, what's really important here is that these books are peer reviewed by experts. So these are scholars working in universities in the West where there's ample freedom of speech. So these books I recommend because they're actually part of a new movement in Vietnam studies. So a lot of scholarship on Vietnam, until this recent wave of scholarship, has kind of ignored the Republic of Vietnam, so South Vietnam. Even when you watch American documentaries about the Vietnam War, think of Ken Burns, for example, or just in popular discourse about the war, they mostly focus on the communists narrative. But this kind of conflates Vietnamese communism with Vietnamese nationalism. But the Republic of Vietnam represented a different kind of nationalism. So my short answer to you is that these are very well-respected scholars in academia, and there's a rigorous, rigorous peer review process is basically what I want to say. So if you were to, for example, look at other sources that were not peer-reviewed by scholars, then I would, you know, be more careful there. But I would say that these scholars are taking a careful, nuanced approach, and they're very well aware of the different angles that you can look at Ngo Dinh Diem. Now, what I want to add on is that in the past, many American historians have kind of portrayed the Republic of Vietnam as sort of an aberration in the history of Vietnamese nationalism. And basically, the standard narrative in the United States often reflected the communist narrative. Funny enough, really, and that kind of makes sense when you think about it, because in the 60s, and who were all the people who would become professors? They were very left, right? They were anti-war. And so many of them were quite sympathetic to the communists. And so a lot of them kind of portrayed South Vietnam as puppets, right?
Yeah.
And as kind of simple, as sort of monolithic and not complex. So a lot of that historical work sort of flattened the Republic of Vietnam. And I have to admit to you, Ken, I kind of bought into it because I would read that stuff, you know, and I kind of thought that, oh, they're nothing but sellouts. They're reactionary, you know. But this new wave of scholarship is telling us, let's take the Republic of Vietnam seriously. And what they're doing, this new wave of scholarship, is they're showing that the Republic of Vietnam was not a puppet government just following Americans, but they actually had their own ideas and their own agendas. And so this is making the historical narrative more inclusive.
Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful, beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Okay, can I stop you? I am so glad that you brought that up about yourself, because I wonder where you stood politically. And I know you're a very nuanced person, but at the same time, I'm always curious and afraid to broach the topic. But I'm glad you brought that up, because I do experience this sort of question in my own mind about puppets, and the research and the academics not being present in front of mind for me and my peers. We just don't hear enough about it. And I know the movement that you're talking about is with like Professor Tung Vo and Alex Tai, and because that was a new thing for me when I saw them kind of putting this idea of, hey, the Republic of South Vietnam is much more than what we thought it was, or what I thought it was. So I'm glad that there's a movement to kind of illustrate and illuminate all these things. And I'm glad that you brought it up and that you bought into some political thought in the beginning. And now you're kind of like opening it up for more nuances. So this is important to kind of like put it out there before we start with Ngo Dinh Diem.
Yeah. Yeah. So good. And one thing that I want to add here is, and I believe our last episode, I had briefly mentioned that I talked to my family, my parents, about Ngo Dinh Diem. And I said that my dad said he was quote-unquote bad, and my mom said he was good. And my dad got upset at me. He texted me and he said, Kevin, I'm quoting him, I'm reading from his text. He said, tread Ngo Dinh Diem topic carefully. I don't think I said he's a bad person per se, only his policy of suppression. But I think he was an aloof leader, got controlled by his brother, especially his sister-in-law and the U.S. In the end, I think he got a raw deal with the assassination. In my opinion, after that, the death of the South is sealed there. And then a bunch of corrupted guys took turn grabbing power and money, all in the illusion of fighting communists. And then he ended with an angry emoji.
So, you know, my mother was not obviously as eloquent, but she said the same thing to me.
Okay.
She said the same thing to me, you know.
Yeah. So some may agree or disagree with parts of what my dad said, but I will heed his advice to tread carefully. So, Ken, I think one way to do this episode is this. So we'll start with a very short bio of Ngo Dinh Diem, and then we'll walk through key historical events, so well-known historical events, to see Ngo Dinh Diem's roles in this historical drama. And then what I want to do is I want to focus on his theory of personalism. That's his ideology here. And talk a bit more about the anti-communist ideas in the South more broadly. So,
okay.
Sound good?
Let's rock.
All right. So, by the way, I say Ngo Dinh Diem, but you say Ngo Dinh Diem. Should we stick with one?
Well, I mean, it just kind of talks about, it just really showcases where we're from. Because Ngo Dinh Diem is the way somebody in the South would call it, and Ngo Dinh Diem is somebody from the North who's more formal speaking would pronounce it. So I think you should stick with your pronunciation, and I'll stick with my, if you're okay with that. Because it would just feel unnatural for you to pronounce it the way I do and vice versa, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and this is the beauty of like our conversation is like we could approach the same figure from two different places, especially like in these subtle things like pronunciation.
Yeah.
So you don't mind if that's okay with you.
Yeah. So I'll give a really quick bio and then we'll give a longer historical bio and stretch it out after. But okay. So Ngo Dinh Diem was born in 1901. And he was assassinated in 1963. He was born in Hue into a family of Mandarins. So we had talked about what Mandarins are. They're officials in the Vietnamese imperial court. Ngo Dinh Diem, his family was Roman Catholic. And his Catholic name was Jean-Baptiste.
He was also very, very Confucian. By the way, listener, this is not a contradiction. You can be a Catholic and a Confucian at the same time. Confucianism says nothing about the afterlife. Catholicism is a religion that has a lot to say about the afterlife. So he studied law. He graduated in law from the French University in Hanoi. And then from 1919 to 1932, he served as a provincial governor. And then he worked in the Bao Dai administration.
Okay, I want to stop you real quick. He was born in 1901, and in 1919 was a provincial governor. So that made him a governor at 18 years old. That's crazy.
Yeah. So he's getting involved in politics at a very young age. So he's the Minister of the Interior by 1933 under the Bao Dai administration, which, of course, is under French colonial rule. And then in 1933, he kind of rejects Bao Dai's, what he saw as subservience to the French colonial authorities, and he resigns. And by the way, he's a devout Catholic, as I had mentioned. He also built his reputation as being a workaholic and also being incorruptible. So in these years, he's working a lot. And even Fanboy Cho, by the way, was friends with him in Hue from 1933 to when Fanboy Cho died in 1940. And Fanboy Cho called him, quote, a truly good man. So they were friends. And as we had mentioned in the last episode, or a few episodes ago, the Japanese occupy Indochina between 1940 and 1945. Moon and Zim actually had few qualms with colluding with the Japanese against the French. He didn't see the Japanese as so bad. He thought there was an opportunity there. During the war between 1945-46 to 1954, so that's the first Indochina War, he was known as what in French they would call an attentiste, meaning something like a fence sitter, somebody who won't choose a side, somebody who kind of waits. So he doesn't want to choose to go fight with the communists, right? But he also is against the French. So he wants to create this, what we would call a third force movement, which is anti-colonialists and anti-communists. In 1945, he's captured by the forces of Ho Chi Minh, and Ho Chi Minh actually offers him a place in Ho Chi Minh's government, but Nguyen Dinh Diem refuses. In 1947, he founds this group called the National Union Bloc, which was anti-communist and nationalist.
Okay, I'm so sorry. Can I stop you?
Yeah.
So you said that Ho Chi Minh captured Nguyen Dinh Diem in 1945?
Yeah.
And why was he let go?
Well, Nguyen Dinh Diem was an anti-colonialist. And, you know, we have to keep in mind that the Viet Minh was led by communists, but they wanted to be a broad coalition of anybody who was anti-French. And keep in mind, this is the beginning of the war against the French here. So Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh have a lot more, you know, to fight against. It's the French that is their main problem. So now, as I had mentioned, he founds this National Union Bloc that's supposed to be anti-communist and nationalist. And for Americans who are aware of this anti-communism, this background is making him an appealing candidate in the eyes of the Americans for political leadership. So Nguyen Dinh Diem breaks with Bao Dai and the Viet Minh in 1949. Okay, so I want to read a quote from Nguyen Dinh Diem. In 1949, he says, quote, "It should be known that the present struggle is not only a battle for the political independence of the fatherland, but also a social revolution, Gakmang Sahoi, to restore independence to the peasants and workers of Vietnam, in order that each and every person in Vietnam can have sufficient means to live in a manner befitting the dignity of a man who is truly free. I advocate social reforms that are sweeping and bold, with the condition that the dignity of man will always be respected and will be free to flourish." What do you think of that quote, Ken?
Makes perfect sense. Who wouldn't want that, right?
Well, so there are a few things I want to point out about this quote, and it's going to foreshadow our discussion of what is called personalism. His emphasis on the word dignity of man. Keep in mind, he's a Catholic. Christians talked a lot about human dignity. For Christians, dignity is this inherent worthiness of being a human. All human beings are born with inherent dignity because we are all, in their eyes, children of God, right?
I mean, it sounds very similar to the opening of the Constitution of the United States.
Yeah. We are all equal because we're all children of God. It's a very Christian idea.
Christian way of looking, yeah.
Yeah. Now, another thing I want to point out in that quote is his emphasis on social revolution. Tekmek Sawit. He doesn't elaborate on the meaning of social revolution, and this is going to end up being a problem, I think, and we'll talk more about that. But anyway, I just wanted to emphasize those two things. He emphasizes dignity, and he talks about it in terms of a revolution. So he's not saying he's a conservative here. Okay, anyway, moving on. So from 1950 to 1954, he's exiled. He's outside of Vietnam. He's traveling all around the U.S. He spent some time in California, and he's also in Europe. He's making connections with Americans, and we'll talk more about that. Now, if you remember in our episode on Bao Dai, there was a country that was set up kind of by the French, right? It was called the State of Vietnam from 1949 to 1955, led by Bao Dai. And Ngô Đình Diệm became the last prime minister of the State of Vietnam in 1954. So there were about five prime ministers before him, but he was the last one. The point I want to make here that's important for the listener, and this is a point that Edward Miller makes in his book, Miss Alliance, is that Ngô Đình Diệm is not this person who was installed by the U.S. or kind of plucked out of nowhere. Ngô Đình Diệm was, quote, I'm quoting Edward Miller, a prominent and active figure in Indochinese politics who successfully engineered his own appointment as premier of the State of Vietnam. So in October 1955, a year after he's prime minister of the State of Vietnam, he deposes Bao Dai. And he had himself confirmed in, I would say, a rigged election in 1956.
98%, you mentioned.
Right. So here we have the creation of a new country, the Republic of Vietnam, or what we call South Vietnam. So the State of Vietnam kind of becomes the Republic of Vietnam. So I'm just going to go really quick here for through the rest of this line, then we'll go into deeper detail. But he, as we will talk about later, he gives preferential treatment to Catholics at the expense of Buddhism. He is said to have alienated many other groups in Vietnamese society. He maintains order through a harsh and anti-communist repressive regime, with his brother leading the head of the political police. And increasingly, he falls out of favor with the United States for his brutality, I guess. He ends up being assassinated along with his brother with tacit U.S. approval, and his assassination deprived South Vietnam of its last strong leader with the ability to maintain authority. Okay, so that's very, very fast. So he's assassinated in 1963. Now, I think we can kind of rewind and then walk a bit more slowly through the historical events.
And I want the audience to know that it takes you a long time to put these details together. And here's why I think it takes a while. Because distilling this kind of information into a short, compact brief for audiences, you got to figure out what to leave, what to keep, what to put out there. So thank you so much for preparing this. And you know, we can build the episode and the questions based on your work with that. So thank you so much.
And I just want to remind the listener that we're interested in these figures because they illuminate Vietnamese history more broadly.
Yeah.
These figures are a window into Vietnamese history. So it's not so much the person that we're interested in, but it's what can they teach us about the history? So let's go back to 1954, in May of 1954. France is defeated at Dien Bien Phu. Now, keep in mind, the French don't immediately leave the next day, right? There's still French presence. There's still French influence in the South. And by this time, the United States really wants France to keep on fighting. The U.S. does not want the communist Vietnamese to take over the entire country. So there are peace talks in Geneva, and the parties agree to split the country into two, North Vietnam, South Vietnam. And North Vietnam is called the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, which is communist, and the South Vietnam is anti-communist, and it's called the State of Vietnam, and then the Republic of Vietnam. Now, there was an expectation that there would be elections in 1956 to reunify the country. By the way, South Vietnam never agreed to that point, that there would be elections. Anyway, the elections never happened. So now the United States, and it's important to bring up the United States at this point, because they are focused on creating an anti-communist state in South Vietnam. Keep in mind, many in the South at the time were still very much with the Viet Minh. Now, then there was a period of about 300 days, 1954, 1955. Pick a side and move there. Initially, it was kind of for the military, but it also included civilians. So you had moving from the North about 900,000 to 1 million, moving South, and maybe like around a quarter of that number moving from the South to the North, a quarter to a third of that number.
No, I never knew that there was a reverse migration from the South to the North in that
period. Oh, yeah, yeah. Not as much as from the North to the South, but certainly. Now, at this time, there's kind of propaganda wars, right? So the U.S. and the CIA is trying to spread rumors that Catholics are going to be persecuted and killed if they stayed in the North. I even heard that some U.S. officials were hinting that the U.S. would drop nuclear bombs in the North, trying to scare people to move from the North to the South. But of course, people moved North to South for many other reasons, right? The U.S. provided ships for refugees. Anyway, lots of propaganda moved yeah, our side, right?
And I understand a lot of religious, a lot of Catholics moved from the North to the South. And in fact, I hear my mom's side, the generation of the 1954 Northerners, all say that, oh, the Catholics, there was 1 million Catholics that moved from North to South. Yeah. And it seems like such co-opted by Catholics, Vietnamese Northern Catholics, that they got their freedom because they moved to the South. So it seems very religious-based as well.
Certainly a lot of Catholics. My family, too, my mom's side, especially Catholics. My aunts or none.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a big thing because we are the product of Northern 1954 people that moved from the North to the South that were Catholic, predominantly Catholic. And I think Ngô Đình Diệm's presidency is a big sort of like marker, a deep line of demarcation between Catholics and Buddhists. And at the time, or I think even still in the country today, it's 70-30. Or at that time, is that right? There's an overwhelming number of Buddhists compared to Catholics. And to have a Catholic, quote unquote, a president at that time pressuring the Buddhists, I think that's something that we need to get into
a bit. We will talk about that later in this episode, the relationship with the Buddhists. Okay, we'll get there. But one thing that I want to emphasize at this point is by the mid-1950s, there's a big difference between the North and the South. The North is politically stable in terms of having one political ideology. One political ideology, which is Marxism-Leninism. It's very coherent, it's very unified, and also the North has pretty strict control over the press. So they have control over the ideas. The South is a lot more fragmented. You also might say this, that the South was a lot more free in terms of the diversity of ideas. That could also be a bad thing or not a useful thing when it comes to war, right? But anyway, so in 1954, the United States Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, he thinks that Ziem is exactly the kind of anti-communist that the Americans can count on. And the Americans, there are different American leaders who are looking to Ziem at this point. There is, however, this anecdote that Edward Miller opens his book up with, the speeding limousine anecdote. And I think it's pretty illustrative. So Ngo Dinh Ziem arrives in Vietnam after being abroad, 1954, and Vietnamese people are excited to see him. And they're waiting, crowds are waiting to see him. But he speeds by in his limousine with his windows up, and the crowd kind of groans. They're like, what? Like, such a disappointment. And so at this point, Edward Lansdale, who recounts his story, he's a very important figure. He has a really close relationship with Ngo Dinh Ziem. He's basically with the CIA at this point, and he's really trying to cultivate, mentor Ngo Dinh Ziem. But he tells a story, but Edward Miller is going to say, actually, that's not really true. Ngo Dinh Ziem knew exactly what he was doing. And that night, later that night, he actually met a lot of Vietnamese in crowds and shook people's hands. Like, he's very calculating, you know. So, but Edward Miller just wants to debunk this idea that in the American eyes, Ngo Dinh Ziem was naive about politics. He wasn't politically experienced. But Edward Miller once said, actually, he was a lot more clever than this.
So what was the point of zooming by in a limo that had the windows up?
Well, is this the point of this story, as recounted by Edward Lansdale, is that Ngo Dinh Ziem was out of touch.
Okay.
But Edward Miller wants to say, that's Edward Lansdale's perspective. Later that night, he didn't realize that Ngo Dinh Ziem met a lot of people.
Yeah, but why did what do you think was the point of him keeping the windows up and not connecting with the people?
So I think, if I can remember clearly in the book, I think they had planned to go somewhere else and they needed to get there quickly or something. They just didn't have time. I could be wrong, but it's not important.
Yeah,
I don't know. But one important point to make here is that when Ngo Dinh Ziem becomes the first president of South Vietnam, he is up against a lot in South Vietnam. South Vietnam is just chaos, because in South Vietnam, you had communists, you had colonialists, you had seditious army generals, you had different religious groups like the Cao Dai, which is like a group of Buddhists kind of melting together Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism, Catholicism. It was founded in 1919. You had the Hua Hao. The point I want is, and you also have this kind of gang criminal syndicate called the Binh Xuyen in South Vietnam. It's just groups competing for power, okay? It's chaos. And many of these groups had cooperated with the Viet Minh, but then later fought against them. But the point I want to make here is that Ziem he's president now, but it's just, he's up against a lot of rivals is what I want to say. And the United States kind of kept pressuring Ziem to build coalitions with these different groups. But Ziem would have other ideas. You know, he saw many of them as rivals, and he kind of didn't really listen to the Americans on this. He kind of annoyed the Americans here. So one interpretation of how do we explain the U.S. and Ngo Dinh Ziem alliance is that this is a product of American Cold War geostrategic calculations. You know, the U.S. is trying to contain communism. And so that's one interpretation. And the U.S. officials also see Ngo Dinh Ziem as arrogant, even though they think he's the best guy for the anti-communist job. So the U.S. is trying to protect Ziem from rivals in the South Vietnamese army. And people will say that Ziem is a puppet. You've heard that, right? Like, we always hear that Ziem was a puppet, right? But if that's the case, why did the U.S. want him removed?
Right. This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars. to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
What is Dax, are you?
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all, so we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So,
well,
yeah.
All right. Well, I have thought a lot about this. You could functionally be a puppet, but the puppet could sometime have its own mind. So I think that for practical purposes, the world would see him as a puppet, but the puppet had its own sort of like, it became human and it became conscious of its own decisions. So I think functioning in the role of a puppet for the Americans was perhaps something that was really real. But then he started to say, well, look, I might be using them like they're using me.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, without a doubt, he got a lot of money and aid from the United States. Between 1955 and 1961, South Vietnam was the fifth largest recipient of U.S. aid. Now, Ed Miller says that Ziem disregarded U.S. advice more often than he followed U.S. advice. Okay. So, I had mentioned right now that South Vietnam was a huge recipient of U.S. aid. Now, there's something kind of wrong with that, right? If you're fighting a war, this is kind of unsustainable to get most of a lot of your money from and support from the U.S. The U.S. gave Ziem money and weapons and gave South Vietnam a lot of consumer items rather than industrial machinery. So by the late 1950s, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, they have a lot of new weapons, but the leadership is not so strong, right? Ziem implements a campaign. We had mentioned this in the last episode because Nguyen Thi Dinh is going to react to this. His campaign, the Denounce the Communist campaign, so 25,000 or so suspected or more suspected communists are sent to detention camps where many are tortured and executed. So by the mid-1950s, I'm going to kind of talk about the North right now. The North thinks that it should be more aggressive in the South. And up there, Lê Duẩn is going to lead this. 1959, we're moving on. Ngô Đình Diem's policies in the countryside are alienating the rural population. We talked about that in the last episode. And this is actually helping the communist cause. This is making peasants angry. And at this point, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, North Vietnam, they're building trails to send troops to the south. So we call that the Ho Chi Minh Trail, right, going around into the south. By 1960, communist leaders are calling for representatives of diverse groups hostile to Ngô Đình Diem to come together. Basically, if you don't like Ngô Đình Diem, come together. We will create what's called the National Liberation Front, the Viet Cong, basically. In the south, right?
The birth of the Viet Cong.
Right, right. So this war is a civil war between Southerners as well, not just between North and South, but between South who supporting Lodinzian and South who did not support Lodinzian. And so this, many peasants are going into the communist fold. In 1961, John F. Kennedy takes office. And so between 1961 and 1965, Hanoi up in the north and in Washington, the U.S., are very committed to gaining control over South Vietnam. So Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, who was the vice president at the time, they don't want to get defeated in their own politics back home, right? They're scared of a conservative rebellion against the Democratic Party. And so Kennedy promises to fight the Cold War harder. You know, I will fight these communists. So at the time, Robert McNamara is the Secretary of Defense. And at this point, we have to talk about the Americans here, because this is important, because Kennedy is going to give more and more aid to South Vietnam, more military assistance, more military advisors. And then 1961 to 1962, Kennedy wants to stand behind South Vietnam to show the world, to show America's allies that America is serious about its commitment to anti-communism. By 1962, the U.S. is kind of optimistic, actually. So it seems like things are working. Ngo Dinh Diem creates the famous Strategic Hamlets program, which is intended to separate peasants into communities to keep them away from communists. But this actually made many peasants angry. It uprooted them from their ancestral villages, and the communists would just keep recruiting those people and then keep on getting stronger.
Now, wouldn't that be, it's like common sense when I think about this, right? Like, why would you uproot people in their own village, make them, create discontent, make them unhappy, and then the Vikal would come in and say, hey guys, here we are. If you're unhappy about the way this is going down, we are here to provide a safer place and to rebel and attack against this plan to put you guys in a pen.
I'm going to talk about this a bit later, but what's really fascinating is an essay written by Zui Le Nguyen. He's a professor at, in Texas. But he wrote a fascinating essay about how that program was actually inspired by Ngo Dinh Diem's personalist philosophy, which we will get to later. And it's actually a kind of Marxist humanist revolutionary philosophy to decentralize political power and to create a kind of bottom-up democracy. But we'll get to that in a bit. Okay, anyway, so the U.S. is then not happy about the performance of the Diem regime, and they become more and more doubtful about it. One of Ngo Dinh Diem's brothers, Ngo Dinh Nhu, he cracks down on Buddhist protesters. And so Diem would give privileges to Catholics and scorn Buddhists. Now here, I think we should talk about this so-called Buddhist crisis. Now, I want to start by saying that Diem did have some Buddhists working in his government, in his cabinet. Several were in top command posts in the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. They were Buddhist generals, okay? So he did include Buddhists. However, Catholics dominated the Republic of Vietnam bureaucracy. And so there's a lot of tension brewing between the Buddhists and Ngo Dinh Diem's government here for many different reasons, one of which is that they had very different visions or views on post-colonial nation building. So some would also argue that the Buddhists were working for the communists, right? I don't know how true that is, but one thing that I want to start, I briefly want to just pull out from this book here, because so in 1963, in May of 1963 in Hue, there were Buddhists who had gathered in the courtyard of a radio station, and they were there to listen to a special broadcast to mark the occasion of the birth of the Buddha, basically. But the government, the Republic of Vietnam government, they didn't allow the Buddhists to celebrate because, and I thought this was so striking, I'm reading from Ed Miller's book here, the station manager refused to play a tape recording that the Buddhists wanted to be played on the grounds that the tape had not been cleared by government censors. So here you just get this idea that the Buddhists really think that Xi'an's government doesn't care about them, right? That they're privileging Catholics. And some Buddhists saw Ngô-Đình Diệm's personalist revolution as an attempt to impose Catholicism onto the Buddhists, basically. And so the South Vietnamese government, you know, ends up kind of shooting at Buddhists who are protesting for the right to wave Buddhist flags. Then, of course, in June of 1963, which is just a month after that incident I just mentioned, a Buddhist monk sets himself on fire in Saigon in protest of Diem's what they view as persecution of Buddhists. And Madame Nhu, right, Ngô Đình Nhu's wife, responds to it infamously. Like, it is pretty awful. She calls it a barbecue. She says, let them burn and we shall clap our hands. So Ngô Đình Diệm is going to blame these anti-Diem protests on the communists. And so many Buddhist leaders are arrested by Diem's people. Diem declares martial law. The Americans don't like what's going on. They see Diem as a narrow-minded tyrant that his own people don't really see as legitimate. So it looks like the U.S. wants to get rid of Diem. So some argued that a coup would be bad because it would cause instability in South Vietnam. At the time in 1963, Kennedy is indecisive. He leaves the decision to an ambassador named Henry Cabot Lodge, who kind of wants the coup. So Lodge says to the South Vietnamese generals, we are ready to support you. And they murder Ngô Đình Diệm. And so the U.S. expects the new government to be stronger against the communists, but it turns out that the new government is actually tired of war and they kind of want to negotiate with the communists. Anyway, Hanoi reacts by fighting harder in the South. Lê Duẩn and the leaders up there become more powerful than Ho Chi Minh. By then, Ho Chi Minh is old. He's 70 years old. He has little authority over day-to-day policy making. So actually, this coup makes the problem worse for the United States. In a few weeks, I'm almost done here, a few weeks after Diem and his brother are killed, Kennedy is assassinated. So this is November 1963. So I kind of just zoom through the 50s and early 60s here.
Yeah. Kevin, I have a lot of questions. Yeah. I have a lot of questions. I think one of the first questions is, do you think, just from your sort of scholarly work, do you think that we would be in a different place had Diem not be assassinated? Do you think that that was a miscalculation on the United States government's part? Because they were tacitly in on this, right?
So you are asking me a question about a counterfactual. We academics and historians call it a counterfactual. We don't know, like, what could have been, right? What could have been? I think my best answer for you would be, I mean, it depends on what moves he would be willing to make. One thing that Ho Chi Minh's Viet Minh had an advantage over is that they were willing to build broad coalitions. Ngô Đình Diệm was not so much a coalition guy. Now, this is a good segue to a really important thing I want to talk about is Ngô Đình Diệm's theory, his ideology of personalism. This is kind of the essence of Ngô Đình Diệm's thought, so I want to talk about it now. So we're good on time, are we? We could go so long.
We can keep going.
So the politics of the state of Vietnam and later the Republic of Vietnam grows out of this strand of what Nguyen Trân calls revolutionary nationalism, and which is a kind of anti-communist nationalism. This is a kind of revolutionary nationalism which is anti-communist. So in 1953, the anti-communists come together and they try to articulate a shared vision of a fully free Vietnamese republic that is free from the French, that is united by their anti-communism. But this is kind of a problem, right? Because they're all against something. But then the question is, well, what are you for? The communists have an advantage because, well, they have a pretty clear vision. They have a doctrine. They have Marxism. They have a text. You know, it's clear. It's coherent. But the Republic of Vietnam is going to be plagued by factionalism, division, instability. It's the most politically diverse, pluralistic society in Vietnamese history. It's rich in diversity. Now, diversity might be good in peacetime, but in wartime, if you ask me, it doesn't sound so helpful for war, right? So Diem's faction is arguably the most illiberal of the anti-communists. So he kind of declared himself the Republic of Vietnam's first president, right? He favors severe limitations on civil liberties. He insists on controlling the government. He pressures other groups to join. Others are going to want more political pluralism, more power sharing, right? More liberal and representative democracy. And so they're going to break away from Diem in the latter half of the 1950s. But Diem has this reputation for cracking down, arresting opposition figures, alienating his rivals. Now, yeah.
Okay. This is a problem that I have, and I have to ask this question. This starts, I think, in wars throughout from the start of mankind. But let's just take it from where Diem is in Vietnam. Cracking down and persecuting and killing people and putting them in camps sounds very familiar to what the communist does to the losing side. How can we as modern people not look at that as a problem, that we have to look at our lineage as children of the South and the government and say, look, we did it to them, they're going to do it back to us? Or is that just part of war and life in wartime?
Ken, there are two ways of getting somebody to do what you want them to do. Number one, you can use a gun. You can coerce them to do what you want them to do. However, you can also do the second option, which is you can try to persuade them with an idea. Okay? The communists and the anti-communists were trying to do both of these things. The communists were able to persuade people to adopt Marxism-Leninism. We talked about the story of Winty did. Now, I want to get to the ideology of personalism. Ngô Đình Diệm was not only trying to control people by jailing them and persecuting them. He was also trying to persuade them with an ideology that is largely inspired by his brother. So I keep saying I'm going to talk about it, but I'm finally going to talk about it. Okay, personalism. It's a revolution. It's something new. Okay, what is it? So personalism, American journalists were kind of confused by it. They thought that it was just a hodgepodge theory. It was whatever Ngô Đình Diệm wanted it to be, right? But it actually comes from a longer tradition. So personalism is essentially a critique of liberalism and collectivism. Here's what I mean. So we tend to think of the war between Ho Chi Minh's North Vietnam and Ngô Đình Diệm's South Vietnam as a war between communists and anti-communists. But perhaps a more accurate way of putting it is that it was actually a war between two kinds of Marxism: Stalinism in the North and Marxist humanism in the South. That will blow people's minds if I suggest that Ngô Đình Diệm was a kind of Marxist. Yes, he was. Here's what I mean. So personalism, this ideology, is a Marxist-humanist critique of liberal democracy. It criticizes capitalism. So Ngô Đình Diệm is an kind of an anti-capitalist. Why? Because he believed that capitalism alienates the individual. He's going to get these ideas from Ngô-Dinh Nhu, his brother. But they get personalist philosophy from a French Catholic philosopher named Emmanuel Mounier. And Mounier was an anti-capitalist. Okay, he thought that capitalism was alienating individuals. And so Ngô-Dinh Nhu and a French piece, a priest, they create basically seminars or schools devoted to personalism. They held events in Da Lat, in Hue, in Hanoi, in Saigon, and they were trying to teach people about this new ideology. And what's interesting here is that Ngô-Dinh Nhu was actually quite pro-worker. He was pro-union. As a student, he advocated worker cooperatives. But he was not so much a communicator of ideas. He was not like Ho Chi Minh, who was a lot more skilled in promoting ideology. So Ngô-Dinh Nhu and Ngô-Dinh Diem together, they found this party called the Gần Lao Party, the Revolutionary Personalist Workers' Party. So this is kind of their political party that is going to promote this personalism. Now, personalism argues that capitalism is bad because it makes some wealthy and powerful. And he argues that Western liberal democracy is hypocritical. It gives liberty to some citizens, but it's unable to address the common good. Now, if you're a leftist Marxist, you're like, oh yeah, exactly. That is the kind of Marxist critique that all my friends on the left make of capitalism, right? Of liberalism and capitalism. So personalism is going to correct for the shortcomings of liberal democracy. It says that you can have individual freedom, but you also have social obligations. If you're a capitalist, a liberal capitalist, you don't really give a darn about social obligations. You only care about, you're being selfish. You just want to be an individualist, right? So Ngô-Dinh Diem's personalism has three fundamental principles. Number one, the absolute worth of the person. So that's dignity. Number two, the duty of the state to ensure the person's basic rights. And number three, it's a humanistic conception of democracy, that democracy is supposed to develop the person. This sounds pretty good, right? So he's going to say that individualism can be good. It gives freedoms, but it could be bad. If you're too individualistic, then the state becomes less effective to solve social problems. But in the other, on the other hand, if the state is too strong, such as in fascism and communism, it will hurt the individual's freedoms. By the way, just as a side note, up in the North, and also today, I know young Vietnamese personally today who call themselves communists, and they're Vietnamese nationalists, and they call Ngô-Dinh Diem a fascist. Which is fascinating because Ngô-Dinh Diem is going to say, oh, I'm against fascism, right? But anyway, he portrays personalism as this middle ground between individualism and collectivism, between capitalism and communism. So anyway, this...
But Kevin, would it be wrong to say that Ngô-Dinh Diem went through the world, looked at the world in very fascist lenses? Is it offensive to say that?
Through fascist lenses?
Yes. He ruled with the sort of this authoritarian, you know, and I think the way that they, I mean, this is what I heard through family, you know, they put people to death quietly. They assassinated people quietly.
Well, so I'm not sure if I would call that fascism, because fascism has a really specific definition. So have you ever seen a fasces, which is a bundle of sticks wrapped together to make an axe?
Yeah.
Like, fascism is all power to the state. There's no such thing as individualism. You give your whole body and being to the state. And then you can become stronger through fighting other nations, basically. So for the Nazis, fascism is You know, you cohere around the state. But is that what Ngô Đình Diệm was promoting, right? All power to the state?
No. Not promoting it, but did he operate like that?
I guess it's a matter of perspective here.
Said what when it asks.
Yeah, but I just want to read a quote real quick. So Diệm, he says, "Thus we affirm our faith in the absolute value of the human person whose dignity antedates society and whose destiny is greater than time. We affirm that the sole legitimate end and object of the state is to protect the fundamental rights of the human person to existence and to the free development of his intellectual, moral, and spiritual life." Now, what is really interesting here is that he's getting this personalist philosophy from essentially a Marxist humanist French Catholic philosopher. And so his policies are basically trying to promote this kind of Marxism in South Vietnam. That's a different version of Marxism, where it's a decentralized thing. It's not a Stalinist thing. And he wants the state to wither away. Now, this is kind of just mind-blowing to me because I had grown up thinking that Ngô Đình Diệm was like a capitalist, you know, because that's what you think. Oh, if you're anti-communist, you must be capitalist. But he's very much not. Now, the last point I kind of want to make is that this whole personalism ideology sounds good, but it simply doesn't sound very convincing to me.
But see, that's, I was going to bring that up. It's not only not convincing, but maybe it was good on paper for him to like write this stuff, but he didn't really live and kind of fulfill this.
Yeah.
You know, it's all words, right? And that is the problem that I'm having on this episode with Ngô Đình Diệm. It's like, yes, you could write anything. You could say anything in a speech, but did you really live it?
Right. Exactly. And so I think that's one of the big criticisms that you can make. But also one advantage that the Marxist-Leninists had is that they had a very clear social economic program. Here's what we're going to do, right? In the South, it just wasn't very clear, at least to me, it seems. And just with the divisions, right? They were all united in their anti-communism, but it seems like they just couldn't really articulate a positive vision for South Vietnam.
I've had some close people come up to me and have private conversations at dinner and said to me, look, you cannot be fighting and rebelling against your mom and dad. You know, this is what you're doing. You're really fighting against your parental sort of, like, it's a natural thing that teens do to rebel against what their mom and dad said. And on some level, I can understand that because I do rebel against the Vietnamese Catholic part of me. And I do, at this point in my life, I'm questioning the politics that my mom and dad come from. And not all of it is bad. I'm not saying that. But certainly to be able to look at Ngô Đình Diệm in a fair light is what we're trying to do, right? And saying these things is not rebelling. It's just, I just want to see the full picture now. And I think, yeah, you're going to say
something. But I need more clarity. Do you see yourself as rebelling against what?
I see myself as questioning everything that I was raised with, including Ngô Đình Diệm was our hero for the entire 1954 Northern 1 million people. I question that.
Well, one thing I do want to do right now is to briefly play a thought experiment and try to sympathize, actually. Like, put yourself in his shoes, okay? Let's say you don't want to live under a Stalinist communist society where you have total centralization, right? How do you create an anti-communist Vietnam when the South is just full of rivals and maybe you don't want to oppress people, right? But they are scheming against you.
And they're going to kill you.
Right, right. So like you're up against a lot.
Yeah.
What do you do? right? I'm not trying to excuse anything that he did here, but it's...
I don't have a problem with what you just said. What I'm saying is I wish our parents were more transparent in the way he's portrayed. Look, he did everything he can to liberate our people, and in fairness, we were beneficiaries of his goodwill. Cool, that's great. But it came at the price of persecuting other people, the Buddhists, right? And we're not even talking about communism or anything beyond that. For me, it's like, well, what about our brothers and sisters in Buddhism? Yeah. You know, how is that like fair when you really tear into other people's beliefs? So I just want the full picture. Yeah. Yeah. Instead of just saying Odin Yim is our hero, you know, I want more information. That's it.
Another flaw, I think, I'm sharing my own opinions here. I think in his personalist philosophies, he's basically saying that every individual is a person. You know, that's first and foremost, they are a person. Now, that sounds good. But one advantage that communists have when they're trying to persuade people to get to their side is, look back to our last episode, Nguyen Thi Dinh. When her landlord was drunk and abusing her family, her brother can point to the landlord and say, that landlord belongs to a class of landlords. If you were trying to use Ngodin Zim's personalist ideology here, you wouldn't say that. You would say, no, that landlord's a person.
He's entitled to that.
Yeah, he's a person. He's an individual with dignity. Yeah. But that's just not satisfying to a suffering peasant who is being abused by a more powerful person, right? So one flaw, I think, of this personalist ideology is that it's not so attentive to power relations, whereas Marxists can explain that.
Yeah. And Kevin, you could make I can make the argument that we're experiencing that in the world today in free countries like the United States and Europe. I mean, probably not so much Europe, but in America, we are going through this problem where people who have unbridled wealth and uncontrollable power, we are experiencing this very issue that we feel like we're being stepped on.
This is precisely what makes ideas about socialism attractive, especially to young people, right? Because it helps to explain. I mean, it's one ideology. It's not the only one. But to many, it's a quite compelling ideology. I guess my point here is that personalism just isn't as compelling.
You're right. And I think that, but I don't even know, nor did you really believe in what he wrote about that. I think it was just borrowing it from some...
His brother.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, eventually I think we're going to have to do a whole thing on Ngodin Yu and his wife as well, right? Because those are very big figures that towered over the history during that time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we don't have to get into it anytime soon, but I mean, definitely... every time you hear negative things about Ngodin Yim, you hear, no, that wasn't Ngodin Yim, that was Ngodin Yu, that was his brother. Oh, that wasn't really the brother, that was the brother's wife. Madam Yu, you know, you always hear Madam Yu, always hear Madam Yu.
Yeah. If I could just kind of reflect and on, as we come closer to the end of this episode, is like, how do I feel about the South, Elf? Like, where are my views on the South? Reading about Ngodin Ziem and the South certainly makes me more sympathetic to the struggles and challenges that they were facing. I guess I'll leave it there.
I can empathize with that because I understand the pain and suffering that, because it's never, fighting is never like a one-way street, right? Like somebody offends the other side has to fight back with either equal or more force. So this back and forth of like fighting back and forth has to happen. So Ngodin Yim and Ngodin Yu have to really hit back hard. Otherwise, they're going to die. Yeah, and they did.
Okay, and the second thing I want to say is, so it made me, reading and learning about them made me more sympathetic, but it also helped me better understand why the North won. Can I say that? Like, it makes more sense to me. I mean, if you think about the division, the fragmentation in the South, the weakness of any kind of positive ideology to really get people on the side. Like, it seems almost obvious there.
Wow, that's a big revelation. You know, revolutions seem to all start with this, which is the unhappiness of the people getting together and overthrowing the status quo. And what happens in the aftermath is the tricky part to manage, right?
The trickiest part is, yes, you have the masses of unhappy people, but how do you get them on your side? You need a set of ideas, you need an ideology, you need a vision. And the Marxist-Leninist one was a very compelling one at the time, you know? So,
I think it worked to unite. Yeah. It worked to unite all the guerrillas in the jungles, and it united the people to really fight. And then I think in the South, we had capitalists and business people, they couldn't unite towards one common ideology and you need the bundle of sticks to come together and really cohere to fight this, you know?
Yeah.
Heavy, heavy, heavy. Heavy, heavy, heavy. I still think that Ngo Dinh Diem is a hero to my family, and I can honor that. I can certainly honor that narrative that my mom and my grandmother and grandfather and the rest of the South at the time, especially Vietnamese Catholics, benefited greatly from a lot of the moves that Ngo Dinh Diem did. We completely understand it. But we also have to be honest in his treatment of, for me, my biggest issue was the treatment of Buddhists at the time, then Ngo Dinh Diem. I think it was very, very unfair what the kinds of things that he did and how Madame Yu looked at the burning monk.
You know, if you dig even more deeply into those specific moments of violence, such as I had mentioned briefly, like the government shooting at the protesters or like bombs going off. If you look into them, there's so much controversy around it. Like some are saying, no, it wasn't the government. It was other people. And others like, no, it was the government. Like in the chaos of violence, you can understand the cycle and the blaming, you know, but you know.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but I'm glad we got through this episode. Now, who are we showcasing next?
In our next episode, I think it would be great to look at a very young man named Nguyen An Ninh, and he was very prominent in the 1920s in Vietnam. He was an anti-colonialist, and what's significant about him is that he was trying to tell the young generation to stand on their own feet in the face of French colonialism. So we're going to go back in time before Marxism, Leninism, and anti-communism gained traction in Vietnam. We're going to go to the early 1920s in the next episode.
I look forward to that. There are six characters. There are six names that the Architects of Dignity, your book that was put out this 2024. We are going to be, this is the third figure in the book, right? And I think that we'll work through the next three over the next few weeks. And I look forward to sitting down with you to talk about Nguyen An Ninh next.
Same.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
Wow. What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.